My name is Annie Kleen. I'm talking to you about networking topics. That's various stuff.
Oh. Networking stuff? Okay, now it works better. It's mostly about various parts of the app that are not so well known. So may you find them useful in your own programs. I hope so, at least. Okay. And I first talking about non-blocking sockets and then Unix sockets. Then after that, Netlink. That seems to be one of the lesser known parts. Netlink, then error handling, advanced error handling, pet MTU discovery, and then if you have some time left, a little bit of IPv6. Okay. Okay. Probably most of you who have already done some networking stuff have dealt with non-blocking sockets already, but I will repeat it a bit. It's very useful if you don't want to have many tweets, because if you have many tweets, if you have a lot of connections, you get a lot of overhead with all the tweets of all the kernel stacks that's chewing up your memory and all the context switching and stuff like that. So if you want a really well-scaling server, like Squid, for example, you often use state machines. You use non-blocking sockets. You wait for events from the networking. When an event occurs, you just send a new packet, and that all works without ever blocking at the networking. Okay. And the nice thing of that is that this is very portable. It works on all Unix systems, basically. And it's very simple too. You just have to set it non-blocking and use poll, basically. Okay. And there are a few networking events you can process there that you get from poll. For example, it's incoming data, socket ready for writing. So if you write something and a socket write buffer is full, you have to wait until it's ready. So you have to buffer the data until that, and connection finished. Error occurred, disconnect, and organ data. Organ data is not very important for most people, but it's there at least. okay, if you are in your main loop, in your event loop, and you have a lot of sockets in your own data structures, then you can ask the kernel about the events that I just described. So you are done with poll, that's a system call. You just wait for the event, then run your state machine on the socket. For example, if it's still connecting, you wait. If it's just finished connecting, or if you got some data, you wait for new incoming data. If you, for example, using some proxy or something, and it's very simple basically, but it has a few disadvantages, because all the time when you're calling it, if you're calling it with lots of sockets, like several hundred, several thousand, it does copy a full table of all these sockets to the kernel and back, and that does not scale very well if you are dealing with a lot of sockets and lots of data and on very big machines. And all the time, the kernel has to walk all these tables and the user has to walk them too. And it's a bit slow sometimes. Okay, but it's portable. That's a nice thing on it. Well, and there are some other ways to get at events. One of them is to use retime signals. A real-time signal, compared to just an ordinary signal, you get some data queue. There's a queue for the real-time signal, and the kernel puts events into that, or some other user process, but in this case it's the kernel, and you can just process them, and you don't have to walk big tables, because you directly get a signal that tells you where the event occurs and what file descriptor it did occur, and that scales nicely for most cases. So, okay, but the old signals that are not real-time, they have still some advantages, because they cannot get lost. The problem with the real-time signals is that if the signal queue overflows, it will just get lost, and then you would lose the event, but it's not very good in case of networking server, because then it would forget the connection or stuff like that. So, both of the place, basically. Okay, and the real-time signals are between sig-rt-min and sig-rt-max. That's a special range in the signal space. So if you want to use them, you have to allocate from that. Okay, and if you want to use that for networking I/O, you can use the so-called Qt SigIO. That's a new feature in Linux 2.2. You just set a real-time signal on a socket, and it would normally send a SigIO in this case. But in the SigIO case, you would still need to walk to call Paul and check all the file descriptors for what file descriptor actually the event occurred at. So with Qt SigIO, it directly tells you what file descriptor got the event.
Is this intended to be used for other IO subsystems as well?
Maybe. I'm playing with that idea, but it's not finished yet. So. Yes, it would be useful for that, in my opinion, but there are other people who differ on that. Okay. So, it's a similar mechanism that you have on NT, for example, or FRMS. They have similar, but it's called a bit differently, but you just get an event and process that, and you don't have to walk big tables. And it's basically very simple to use. You just set up a signal handler with the SA SIG info flag, and the kernel supplies and SIG infrastructure to your signal handler, where you can just get the information, like the file descriptor or what happened on the socket and stuff like that. And the problem with that is, there's a small problem with that, because a signal can only be sent to a process or process group. So in case of Linux treats, each treat has an own process ID, so you have to decide before where to get the signal sent. So you are usually tied with that to this to a treat. There are ways to get around that. Yes. but it's a bit hackish. Okay. And here's a quick how to use it. Basically, you just open a socket. If you have the socket FD, you tell the networking stack that you're owning it, so you will get the signal sent. Set your own real-time signal, that's between sigrtmin and sigrtmax, and set up a signal handler, which gets the sig info. And in the signal info handler that you get passed, in the sig info that you get passed to a signal handler, you will have a field that contains the file descriptor where the event occurs at, so you can process it. And then, okay, there's a problem. When there are too many events, there will be an overflow of the real-time queue. So in this case, the kernel will send a fallback signal that's called. In this case, you will get an SigIO. That's the that's an old signal, which cannot get lost because only a bit in a bit mask in the process. And if you get that, you have to just use Paul to walk all the file descriptors and check where an event occurs. So in this case, you will just get the event that will be a bit slower, but it will still work. And in case you don't want to deal with the locking issues with the signal handlers, because usually signal handlers occur out of context and it's hard to lock against them, you have to use sigblock and stuff like that, but it's slow. You can just use a special function called sigtampwait, which just will wait for an incoming signal and give you the sig info of that. So you don't have to use asynchronous signal handlers, you just have an event loop where you use sigtampwait and process it. It's basically just wait for event.
Question. Do you want to mention allocating the real-time signal through glibc so you don't screw up Linux threads?
Yeah, that's one of the problems with the real-time signals. There's not really a standard way to allocate them. We'll address that on the next slide.
In glibc 2.2, there's a next slide.
Okay. That's not really working or not. Okay. Then there was simple basic about event handling, non-blocking event handling. Then for Unix sockets, that's a common way to communicate locally. Okay, they're fast for local communication. They're called AF Unix or AF local and POSIX. That's a typo. It should be AF local. Okay, and they have two flavors. They are available in stream sockets where you're sending streams, like in TCP, so you don't get message boundaries. Or they are available at datagram sockets. They're just passing packets, and they're very, very fast, and there are lots of use, mostly used for Xalf, X, and GNOME, and stuff like that. Okay. And there are a few There are a few problems with Unix sockets. For example, one of them is that it's hard to find a Unix socket. You have to kind of put it into the file system, but in this case, you get some issues with that because if you put it into temp, you have to manage temp, and when it goes away, you may have the wrong user ID and stuff like that. So one of the things we added in 2.2 was to add an abstract namespace for that, that it's not in the file system, but it's managed in the kernel. So you have just a name table in the kernel. And the nice thing with that is that it goes away when the last user vanishes. That doesn't happen in file system objects. And that's a big problem, usually, if you really want to make it work. And okay, if, for example, if a server crashes, it still may have its socket open, but you'd have no easy way to check if the server's still there, except if you are doing your own protocol for that, but it's already ugly. So with abstract namespaces, you can just easily check that just by looking if it's there, and if it's not, create a new one and start a new server and stuff like that. But the drawback of that is that it's non-portable. It's basically a Linux-only feature. So if you want to port to other Unix systems, you are out of luck with that. Okay, and they are very simple to use. You just put a 0 byte into the first byte of the socket Unix. So instead of passing a normal file name or a normal C string, you just put a 0 byte in, and then it's abstract. That's simple. And okay, and the other points already. It's very simple. You have very simple semantics. They go away when the last user vanishes, and it's simpler than file system object. Okay, and the next part is control messages. For example, for a lot of socket, advanced socket stuff, you want to pass more information than you can put directly into send MSG, into the MSG header, for example. So there was an PSD, and the POSIX people invented an mechanism for that. It's called control messages or auxiliary messages. And it only works for datagram sockets. That's a drawback. So you can't use it on TCP. And they're passed out of band by the kernel to you, or from you to the kernel, and they're put into a special buffer. It's called the control buffer. And the sockets RP, because you can put multiple of these messages into a single buffer, if you are doing portable programming, there would be some issues with alignment, and so the socket RP has some standard macros to encode them, and that's really standardized, so it's portable. Okay, and what can you use them for? There are various usages for them. One of them is credential passing for Unix sockets, so you can pass your user ID and group ID to another Unix server, and the Unix server can check if you're allowed to use it. So, for example, I can check the group ID, and the kernel will verify that, so you can trust it. And you can use it for file descriptor passing. That's it. When you have multiple processes and want to pass file descriptors between them, you can just send them as a special message over a Unix socket. And there are some other stuff, like you can receive some special fields from the network. You can ask for on what interface the packet arrived, or what type of servers it had, or what time to live it had. So for usually don't you need that for simple applications, but for some extended applications, it's very useful to have that information. And another way to use it is for sending and receiving IP options, like source routing, or like record route, or stuff like that, because usually would need to have need to use a raw socket for that. So you would need to create all your own packets with an own IP header, and with there are special to solve that problem, there are special socket options where you can pass IP options. And the nice thing is that raw sockets only work for root, but the IP option, that socket ops work for all users, so everybody can use them. It's especially useful for IPv6, where they are more important than for IPv4. Okay, and for IPv6, they use it for a lot of stuff, like for sending extension headers and various other things. Then I will talk a bit about the credential passing. If you have a local server, you often want to authenticate packets you get from a Unix socket. So now, if the client is really allowed to use your server, so if you have a multi-user machine, you won't get security problems. And okay, and if you are, would be using file system objects for that, you would allocate groups for that, and that's visually hard to manage. It works, you have to, but it's easier to just check for every message if you got the right user ID or group ID, because otherwise you would have to manage groups, dynamic groups for that, and maintaining dynamic groups is hard because it's not very portable. It's different on every system. How to add a group, or you have to re-log in all the processes so they can get the new group ID and stuff like that. So it's much easier to just pause it once and check it using your own mechanism, like a configuration file. And okay, it gives you the process ID and the user ID and the group ID of the process, send a message, and it's portable. It's relatively portable. Most modern Unix systems implement it in some way. It's not in all cases 100% portable, but if you encapsulate it in a nice library or something, you can easily port it by just replacing a single function. So it's not a big problem to use them. Okay, and how to use them? It's not very difficult. You just enable a special socket option on the Unix socket. And on the receiving socket, you can use the SOP grid to ask for the credentials of the client at the other side for the last. But for stream sockets, that only works if it's connected, because otherwise you wouldn't know where the packet came from. So for datagram sockets, you can ask it with a special control message that is passed for every datagram that you get on your datagram socket. So you can check for every packet that you get this way, is the user allowed to use me at all? And that these are passed as special control messages. Okay, and there's a special way for root to override that. Usually users can send their own stuff, but the kernel checks it. So if they are setting values for user ID or group ID that they not own, the kernel will just reject it. But if they are root, or if they have the right capabilities, then they are allowed to override that. So, okay, I don't think anything is actually using that right now, but it might be useful for some people. And if they send nothing, if the client sends nothing, the kernel fills in the defaults. So the clients don't even need to be taught about that. The kernel, the server can just do that transparently. Okay. And there are some other usages on Unix sockets for control messages. For example, you can do file descriptor passing. It's basically like a remote dump. You are opening a file descriptor on your own process, and you send a message to some other process that includes the file descriptor in a control message. The control message is called SCM writes, and it simply contains an array of the file descriptors. And you need to use a 1-byte message for that, because the Unix sockets do not really support 0-byte messages. That's one of the common errors with that with that AP. I've seen it a lot of times. And the nice thing, you can use it for a lot of stuff. For example, one nice usage of that is to use an authentication server for some resource that you can express in a file descriptor, like opening of a raw socket, or opening of a packet socket, or opening of some special character device. And you can have a server that just authenticates and clients that ask for that, and then get a file descriptor with that resource passed to them. So they don't need to run as root, only the server needs to run as root, and this way you can do your own authentication. Okay. And it's usually if you want to pass, you want to pass file descriptors between multiple contexts, you need to use treat, but treats are slow and ugly. So in this case, you can avoid treats and just use multiple processes and pass the file descriptors between them. So it makes your programming easier. Okay, is there any questions about that? Yes.
Do you have this posted on the website somewhere?
Not yet, but I will do. Yeah, well, actually. Mm-hmm. Yes, sure. Okay. To the next topic. It's about Netlink. Netlink is a new mechanism. Actually, it's not new in 2.2. It was 2.02, but very primitive in Netlink. In 2.2 was basically rewritten completely. And it's just a generic socket family to pass messages between the kernel and the user. And it's mostly used to synchronize databases, for example, routing tables and various other tables between various users. And it's a very simple protocol. You pass datagrams between users, and it has some. It's not really reliable because in some cases the packets might get dropped, for example, if you're running out of memory. So it has some very simple mechanism to request acknowledgements for that. So you can ask the kernel to send you an acknowledgement so you can detect if your message got lost, for example, a key for out of memory. And oops. And the user interface is via our own socket family. It's called pfnetlink. And okay, it's using for various stuff like routing messages, interface setup, and firewalling. So you can get a packet, you can get a failed packet that failed a firewall rule, or for queuing to netfilter, and updd, and etertap, and various other stuff. And each have their own netlink family. The netlink family is the protocol type you pass in to socket. And netlink messages are very simple. They have a common header with a sequence number, a type, flags, length, and the PID of the sender, or nothing if it's sent by the kernel. And you can set a few flags in them, like an echo or an ACK acknowledgement. And you can use multipart messages, where you put multiple of these messages in a single buffer. They are, for example, mostly used for table dumps. If you're dumping a complete database, then you want a multipart message to avoid too many messages. And when some problem occurs, you get back a special message called NLMSKEERROR. It has the same header as all other messages, but a special type. Okay. And if you want to send a netlink message from user space, use some special macros for that, because that's basically the same problem as with the control messages. If you would do your own setup, you would usually screw up the alignment. So if you were porting to some other architecture, like RM or some other CPUs that are fascist about alignment, then you would screw it up usually, so we supplied some macros for that to make it easier. And if you want to send a message, you just get a buffer and check, use your payload length of your message that you want to send using the NMSKE space macro and put that into the buffer header. Then you you get the NMSKE length with the NMSKE length macro and put it into the buffer header too. and set up the pointer to pointer with, you get a pointer to pointer with NLRSG data, it just points, returns the pointer to the data after the header. And you set it up, and you, then you can send it. It's basically very easy, if you know it. And if you want to receive one from the kernel, you just pass a buffer to receive MSG on a netlink socket, and you get a netlink MSG header. It's at the beginning of the socket, of the buffer of the socket, and you first check if it's okay. In some cases, it might be truncated, so there's a special macro for that. It's called NMMSG okay. So if that returns false, you just ignore the message. And then you check the type and the header, and if it's a message you wanted to see, you look at it, and otherwise you ignore it. And you get a pointer to pilot using NMSG data. And then for some cases, there are special other messages after that. So for example, RTNetlink, I will talk about that later, has some attributes that come after that normal data. And okay, and after you've done that, for multipart messages, you need to look at the next message, and so you just use the NMMSG next macro, which just returns pointer to the next message header. And Netlink has some nice features like multicast groups. There are special groups that are pre-allocated, and when some event occurs, the kernel sends a message to a special group, and the user process can listen to that and look at the event and see if it's interesting for it. And there are 32 multicast groups, and they are specific per Netlink family, so each Netlink family has its own groups, and only root or the kernel can send to such a group. That's to avoid faking from users, the events from users, so otherwise user processes could screw up other user processes by sending fake events. And the user process just bind to them using a bind call, and okay, you can just wait for updates. So you don't have to poll for the updates, you just wait for the updates. That's much more friendlier to the CPU. And one common use of Netlink is the so-called RTNetlink. It's used to configure the IP stack. So the IP stack maintains various databases like the routing table or the IP table or the tables for the traffic control and stuff like that. And to update that, RTNetlink is used. So, and it's actually a superset of the old EOCTL interface. In 2.0, there were just IOCTLs. It updated that stuff. They are still in 2.2 and 2.4, but they're basically deprecated. You should use RTNetlink to get the full spectrum of the available options. And the IOCTL is only a subset. Yes?
Is that portable? That's unportable or portable?
That's unportable, completely. Routing setup in general is unportable. It's very different on every system. And the kernel uses it internally, so if you send an ICTL, it just turns it a Netlink message. And there's some user interface for that, and mostly in IPRoot 2, in IPRoot, in IP, and TC, where you can use that directly, like for setting up policy routing or traffic control or stuff like that. And some of the multicast groups are link, where you can watch for updates on the status of a network link, or neighbor, where you can watch for updates on the IP table, a root, where you can watch for updates on the routing table, and multicast routing table, and the TC, that's the traffic control for stuff like class-based queuing, or diffserv, or similar things. Okay, and RTNetlink messages are basically a superset of the Netlink messages. They just start with a standard Netlink header, the NLMSG header, and a type-specific header. And there are various types for that. And they usually come in three flavors, in new, get, and del. New just creates a new object in the kernel database. Get gets you an object from the kernel database, deletes one. And okay, that's for every object. And get can actually get you a full dump of all the database. If you want to look at roots, for example, then the IP root front end will just use the MLMSG get message. And or you can alternatively just look for specific routes. For example, if you want to check where and what interface a packet would go out, you can could just get the route with that destination address of the packet, and it would just return that route. So you don't have to pass the full routing table in this case. And okay, they can carry attributes. They're used for stuff like extended headers, like if you have want to set a source address in the policy routing, or if you want to set a special interface. So that not everything has to be put into the same structure. So it's just added as dynamic attributes behind the normal message. And the attributes are just like small netlink messages with an etia atria header. Okay, there are a few netlink messages like NuGet and del. I've already said that. There are some netlink, eti netlink families like root, where can pass eti MSG headers to ask for roots or set up roots. And they have lots of attributes like gateway or outgoing interface or incoming interface and some lots of other stuff. It's all documented in the main page. And then there's a new type. It's called address or attr, where it passes an EF attr MSG and it describes a local IP. So if you want, for example, set up an interface, you can use that to pass the IPs of the interface, and it has some attributes too, like if a local, if a label, that's the name of the alias that's associated with it, and some other stuff, and it's all listed in that include file. So if you actually want to see it, you just look at that include file and at the RT Netlink main page. The main page is a bit lacking, but it should be usable for most people. Please?
Does it handle IPv6
addresses? Yes, it does too, yes. The IPv6 has its own message set for that. So it's not common to the IPv4 routing table. It's separated basically, but the IPv6 has its own set of attributes. Okay, and there are various applications for that, and just an ordinary user process, not only if you want to write an EF config or a root replacement. For example, you can use it if you have an application that depends on devices. You can just wait for device up and down. So, for example, if your device is down, you don't even need to look at it. And that's much easier than to poll the interface tables all the time because it uses less CPU. You just get an event if it happens. And in 2.4, you actually have, it has an extension that you can actually watch for the link beat. So if the link beat goes down, it only works for a few drivers yet, but I guess expect it will work for more in the future. You will get a message, and you could, for example, then route to some other device and do a failover for high availability. And you can use that to maintain a copy of the routing table in the routing daemon. So if you're writing gated or OSPF or stuff like that, then you just get the updates from the kernel on the routing table in a netlink message. And you can also maintain a table of the local IP addresses. And there's a kernel part of netlink too, where the netlink, where you can send netlink. Netlink is actually very generic. It's useful for a lot of applications, even outside networking. Just if you want to pass messages from the kernel to some user, usually would do, in the old days, you would do your own device and do your own queuing, but you could use netlink for that too. So it already has all the infrastructure for that, and it's debugged and it's basically saving work. And internally, just using skbuffs, the sends are non-blocking. If you want to, you can have them blocking too. But usually, if you are sending, for example, from interrupts or bottom harvest, you want them non-blocking. And if they fail, you can resend them later. And for incoming messages, you just register a callback, and a netlink family will call the callback with the with a packet, with the netlink packet, and you can pass it and use that to pass the messages you get. And there's some special functions for that, mostly used for dumping tables. So for if you have a big database of some objects and you want to dump them, you can use netlink dump. We have special callbacks that walk the table. It's most used for RTM GET. And there's also a netlink egg. It just sends back an egg if the user requested it. And there are various resources where you can check for netlink. It's in the main pages, netlink 7, RT netlink 7. And if you want some higher level interface than the direct socket interface, you can look at libnetlink, that's included in IPv2. And there's some utility functions. That's some utility functions that make it easier to use. And you can look at include files. They have a lot of comment and document all the standard message types. That's netlink.h and rtnetlink.h. And there are various examples that use it, like Zebra, Bird, IPv2, and some other programs. Okay, any questions about netlink? Nothing, okay. Okay, now I go to error handling. Error handling on networking. Well, networks generate errors. That's probably no surprise for anybody who have done some work on networks. And there are basically two types of errors. They're generated locally. So if, for example, if there's no route to send a packet to, you will get an error for that. Or they can be sent from some other entity like a router on the pad or by the target host. And there are some errors that are fatal, but they just want to stop sending, and others are just need action, like you find out that you lost something and you want to retransmit it or stuff like that. And normally, the normal simple way to handle errors in a BSD sockets API is to the kernel sets an pending error on the socket. And the next time you do something on the socket, you will just get that pending error. So you are waking up before that in Paul or with an RT signal or something like that. And you look at it and then you see some error occurs, but you only get a single error. No, it's not much more. And okay, if you're using TCP, it's very easy to handle errors because TCP nearly does all the stuff for you. It only tells you if it fails, but otherwise it just goes and handles all the errors itself and does retransmit as needed and etc. And for UDP sockets, for datacom sockets, it's a bit more difficult because they don't retransmit. So you have to do a lot more work for the error handling if you want to talk really able to some host. And if you have a connected socket, if you call it connect to it, you will just get a pending error if an error occurs. For example, if the error comes in from some remote host, it sets a pending error and you get it. And you can handle it because you know the destination. And for unconnected sockets, it's a bit more difficult because they talk to multiple targets, and it's hard to find out when you get an error where the error came from. So you know there's some error, but you don't know where the error, for what target you should handle the error. So that was a big problem in the BSD socket API. In Linux 2.2, it was solved by adding an error queue interface. Each socket can have an error queue, and if you enable the error queue, all incoming errors are queued into that queue, and you can receive it. And the error messages tell you where the error came. Okay, it's cut up a bit, where the error came from. So, okay. And it's basically very simple to use the error queue mechanism. You just enable the IP receive error socket option on the socket and do your normal I/O like send MSG, receive MSG, etc. And when you see an error, the socket call returns an error, you do a special receive with the MSG RQ set in the flags and a MSG control buffer on the receive MSG. And in this case, when you get something back, you get the error structure back, the original destination of the packet where the error was generated for is an MSG name. And so if you're doing a receive from, it's in the from address. And in the control buffer, there's an IP receive error control message. And the original payload, as far as our label, is in the normal data buffer. And you just can look at that, decide, okay, I need to handle it. And you said you can do retransmits or stuff like that. And in this case, you do, after you got an error, just do another receive on the socket, or poll on the socket. And if there's another error in the RQ, you will get it, and then after there's no more errors left, it will return nothing, and then you just return to normal processing without MSG RQ.
How does this work with strings?
It doesn't work for streams at all. It's only a datagram mechanism. For streams, it expected that this parallel protocol does it all for you. Yes? You will get your SMP, yes, and the error queue stuff.
Yeah, so it means the next write on that socket will fail?
Yes, it will. It will fail, and you will see that you have an error. And then you can process it, and then you do it again. And the pending error set until the full all of the error queue is consumed.
So I was just wondering how to use this to simulate the
BSD
behavior.
Basically, yes. And okay, how the error messages look like. It's in Linux RQ.h, and they contain the error number, like that's what you usually would get from the socket call, and the origin, that can be origin none, if it's unknown, or ICMP, or local, and some others. And the type, that's for IP, it's the ICMP type, and the ICMP code, so you can directly check for the ICMP. And some ICMP specific info like the gateway for PATMTU discovery and for some messages or the PATMTU for PATMTU discovery. And after that, there's the data, the original payload of the packet. There's not the original payload of the packet, there's the destination address of the source address of the thing that generated the error. Like if it's on router on the pad, you get that information there using the SOC E or Fender macro. It will just return that if you pass it the header. And one of the more interesting applications of that stuff is PATMTU discovery on UDP sockets. For TCP it's easy again. TCP does it all for you. But for UDP, you can use that. And PATMTU discovery, basically the PATMTU is the biggest packet size that can go through an internet path without fragmentation. So you don't have to fragment it. And fragmentation is very bad because it's slow. The receiving host has to reassemble it. And it increases the probability of packet loss because you have two packets instead of a single one, and it makes congestion ever dense harder because you don't know how many packets you have in flight, and it's generally too much work for the router and for the host. And the PATMTU is dynamic and changes, and TCP does it for you. And for UDP and raw sockets, the application has to size its packets correctly because the kernel cannot do it for them. Okay, how does it work? It's not very complicated. The sender starts with an RIS-enabled packet size, usually interface MTU or cached MTU for the destination, and it sets a down fragment bit in the IP header. And when a router would forward to a smaller MTU, it drops it and sends back an ICMP fragment needed message. And the sender receives it and uses a smaller MTU and retransmits it. So,
can you put a little bit more distance?
Oh, yes, sure.
Like that.
Okay.
Because it's distorting a lot.
And on Linux? No, that was too much.
A lot farther. Like that far.
Okay. So
probably best is just to clip it back on. That should be all right.
Okay, thanks. And on Linux, the kernel does it for you in most cases. And when you send a packet and an ICMP gets back, the kernel just keeps track of that in its own destination cache. So it keeps, in most cases, it keeps track of the pet MTU for you automatically. You just have to ask it for it. And but to make it able to keep track of the pet MTU, you have to actually do pet MTU discovery first. So you have to enable it. It's enabled by default for TCP, but for UDP you have to enable it for a special socket option. It's called IP pet MTU discover. And after you've done that and something occurs, if you send a too big message, you will get back an EMSG size error. And after you got that, you can get an use the IPP MTU socket option to get the size for the destination of the socket. But of course, it only works on connected sockets because otherwise the destination is not known. And if you want to do the kernel, all the work on your UDP sockets, it's basically very easy to use. You just turn on the IP MTU discover, the IPP MTU disk wand, and you connect the socket to destination and use IPP MTU to receive the PMTU, send the packet with the PET MTU. If you get an EMSC size because a new PET MTU event occurred between that, you get a new MTU using that trick again and send it again. And it has a few drawbacks. For example, for asynchronous events, you cannot retransmit easily. And but it's very simple because the kernel keeps state for you. And if you want to keep your own state, because if you don't trust the kernel about it, or if you want to at the first try use the correct pet MTU instead of first trying to send a bigger MTU and waiting for the kernel to tell you no, that's not a good idea, you can keep your own kernel, your own table of destinations with MTU. And again, enable it, and enable IP receive error 2, that runs error queuing that we talked about before, and you receive the first MTU. You can do that various way. You can use a default MTU, or you can connect the dummy socket and use IPP MTU on that. Then you send the packet with that size that you got, and when you get an EMSG size, you process the error queue. And the error queue contains various messages, and if they have the right type, like ICMP fragment needed, and the EE code field, you process the EE data and contains the new MTU. So you can update that in your own table and then try again. So you keep your own table of the PET MTUs. And you can map that using the from address. So the from address contains the original destination, so you use that to key into your table. And there are some problems with PMTU discovery, like there are PMTU black holes on the internet, mostly because people configured firewalls and blocked all of ESMP, and then PET MTU discovery doesn't work anymore. And you just see it that when small messages work but big messages don't. A lot of commercial websites have this problem, for example. So if you are on a link with a smaller MTU, then Ethernet, like if you are into a virtual private network or something, it often doesn't work. Maybe you have experienced it now. And for actually to handle that, we would need PMTU black hole handling, but we don't have that yet. We would need some way to detect when we don't get any packets and then turn off down fragment bit, so it might get through, or we could but need some way to decrease the MTU in this case. But it's actually not easy to do, so far it's not implemented. And another problem is that the part MTUs have to be timed out regularly, because otherwise, if the route changes and it gets a bigger MTU again, you would still use the smaller MTU you discovered before, and that would be inefficient. So often you have your own timer. The kernel has a timer, but if you keep it on your own table, you have your own timers for that too. And any questions about that? Yes?
How does it work on non-symmetric links? For instance, if you have a GSM uplink and a satellite downlink, that MTU really kills your connection?
No, not really, because it's only done for one direction. So if the other end sends you, it has to do its own part MTU discovery. Each direction has its own part MTU.
What is the default value for the timeout, the bus MTU timeout?
15 minutes. Something else? Okay, then I will do some very quick introduction to how to port applications into IPv4 zone 6. Well, IPv4 zone 6, I won't describe the basics, you probably all know them already. It has bigger addresses and some other improvements, and it may be the future, maybe it will not the future. People are still not sure about that. And so if you want to port your application for that, it's in most cases not very difficult. You just you have to watch out for a few things, like it has a bigger SOC utter in, it's called SOC utter in 6, and it has more field than the old SOC utter in, so you have to MZ it, otherwise the field could contain garbage. And the ports are shared with IPv4 version 4, and they stay the same, so you don't have to do anything with the ports. That has the drawback that if you bind something to an IPv4 port, then you can't bind another socket to the IPv6 port. So you have to watch out for that. And with the IPv6 RP, you can use IPv4 too with a special case than when the IPv4 address is mapped to the IPv6 address. So then the kernel will just send IPv4 messages in this case. So you don't have to have two APs in your program. You can just use 4.6 and support both. And the SOC utter in 6, well, it has a few new fields. The family, it's INET 6 instead of IFINET. And the port, that's the same as in version 4. And the flow info, that's not actually used yet. It will be used in a future version of version 6 to tag flows. And but so far, we have some support for it in the kernel, but so far, few people seem to use it. It's still a very experimental stuff. So users probably don't want to set it, except if you're doing some special applications. And the SYN7 utter, they just set the address in it. And it also contains the scope ID. That's actually standardized in the RFCs for the version 6 AP. But it's not in Linux 2.2, so it might be not too interesting for you. And the scope ID is used because IPv6 has link local addresses, for example, to tell what scope the address has. And if you get an incoming connection on your port, and it's IPv4, not IPv6, and you have an IPv6 socket bound to it, the kernel transparently puts in IPv4 address into this structure, and you can just handle that, and we'll never see, you'd have never care about if it's for 4 or for 6, in most cases at least.
Is there a way to detect in that whether it was originally a 4?
Yes, there are special macros for that, so that you can run on the address.
So where, I mean, if somebody uses an IPv6 address that looks like one of the translated IPv4,
it cannot happen. They have a special range allocated for that in the 4.6 space, so that's not a problem. And if you just want to do a quick and dirty port, you will probably do just do some search and replace, at first at least. It works for a lot of cases. I did some ported some applications this way. We'll just look for socketer in and move it to 6, socketer in 6. And but you have to look if it's if nothing depends on its size. So, but in most applications, the user do not depend on its size, so that's not a big problem. And okay, you have to replace the socket families. That should be obvious. And you have to replace some other macros, like because the address is a lot bigger, they can't use macros for that, so they have to use special arrays. So inner any that you normally use to bind to a socket is inner any in lowercase, and you have to use a mcapy for that. And for loopback, you use the loopback macro. Mm-hmm. And the name service is a bit more complicated because they added a lot of options, and the old RP was not didn't support multiple socket families because you were pulling directly the IP address out of the structure, and that didn't work, of course. So they invented a new mechanism. It's actually invented by POSIX. It's called get address info and free address info, and resolves that address and the port. So it will set up the socket type and some other stuff. There's a lot of options that I will not describe here. You can look it up in the RFC. And there's getNameInfo to do the reverse. You basically have to change all the, or you have to rewrite all the stuff that deals with names of DNS resolution. So it's a bit more complicated than just search and replace, but it isn't too hard usually. And if you want to do some debugging, you can use the inetp2n function. Oh, and okay, there are some references like the usual IPv6 homepage, and that describes the basic AP. That's basically the stuff that I was talking about, and there's the extended AP. This talks like control messages and how to handle extension headers for the for sending and various other things. So, okay, that was it. Any questions? Okay, sorry. Wow, it's complicated. Oh no, that was the wrong one, sorry.
Don't touch.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah. Does the IPv6 name resolution transparently support IPv4?
Yes, it does, yes. You can basically use all of the 4.6 IPv4 4.4. The only problem in Linux with that is that in some kernels it's not compiled in. So some distributions don't enable it by default. So it might be on Linux, maybe in some cases you still want the old RP, but usually you could use the new RP.
Wouldn't Chile C translate automatically?
No, it doesn't.
You said that the bind port was shared between IPv4 and IPv6. Why?
The people who designed that stuff for the new RP decided it was easier to do the transition this way, because you could transparently handle 4.4 and 4.6 with the same application. Or if you're just binding to a single port, and you can handle both, basically. Some people think it's a bad idea, but
No, it was designed this way, and so we implemented it like this.
Does the API support asynchronous name resolution?
No, it doesn't. Only if you use threads.
Is there a way to do scatter gather I/O on unconnected datagram sockets?
Sure, you can. You just just initialize the R vector on that, and you can do scatter gather I/O. We'll do that transparently. Yes.
The what vector?
There's if you use send MSG. And you have an I/O vector. You just do scatter gather I/O. You put all your buffers in. The kernel does that all the time.
Just giving me a question. So is this a good place? There's some terms you use that I didn't know, like address scoping and stuff like that. I'm not that deep in the networking. Is this a good place to look at that?
The FC, the basic AP FC, will all
define those terms.
Yes.
Okay. Wonderful.
Yes. Near everything, but Glibc is missing a few of the macros, but that's it. And the kernel supports everything, basically. Someone else?
That's 2.2 or 2.4?
That's 2.2. There were only a few improvements between 2.2 and 2.4, like the scoping extension and stuff like that, but it's not. Basically, it's the same. Yes, it's mostly live ready. It's not as well tested as the four stuff, but a lot of people are using it already. So I would still consider it a bit experimental, but it's mostly ready.